Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are
what's up, what's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz, and it's one of our favorites, returning guest, Dr. Bob Swarup. Money mania booms, panics, busts, and Brexits. What do you say, Dr. Bob? How are you?
Fine, Dad. A bit like your Independence Day, we've had ours out here last week.
Not to get right into it, but let's get right into it, because you and I talked about this about a month ago or so, and we said that they were probably would leave, so they left. So you're an economist. You're the boss of Candor Global Advisors. You're the guy who knows all the answers. Come on, baby. Tell me. Give it to me. Tell me what the story is.
Well, listen, I mean, I think, as you said, I always thought there was a chance that Leave would get a narrow victory, and they did. I think what amazes me is that in the aftermath of that, no one was prepared for that. Not even the guys on the Leave side. It's almost as if, you know, they thought they weren't going to win. So when it happened, no one had a plan for what happened next. Yeah, so it's been a bit chaotic here for the last week and a half since that happened. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, when you look at the UK economy, no one actually knows what it's going to look like 1 year or 2 years from now. I mean, what sign you put on GDP growth for the next 2 years basically depends on what your political leaning is, where you remain or where you leave. So from that perspective, it's a great unknown. And to be honest, what I find fascinating is not that what the future in terms of British economic growth might look like. But the fact of the matter is that you had more than half the population choose to leave and walk into more uncertainty than stay with what they knew. And so what this vote actually tells you more than anything else is the sheer level of disenfranchisement and, you know, just lack of belief in the political system that this represents. I mean, the far bigger threat actually out of Brexit is not to Britain, but actually to Europe.
Yeah, no, that is the bigger concern, because the truth of the matter is that Britain themselves, they never totally bought into the euro currency, the whole euro deal anyways. They kept their own pound sterling anyway, so it wasn't like they were 100% in, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, you know, I mean, of course, what it creates problems is in terms of negotiating free trade and so on going forward. But the British always were on the periphery of Europe and increasingly becoming more peripheral. And if you look at the tensions of the last few years, you know, Europe has been on the continent, at least, moving towards what they call ever closer union. In other words, aiming ultimately for full political union. And the British have always vowed and have been very vocal about staying out of it. So I think in many ways, what Brexit actually did was probably accelerate something that would have happened a few years from now anyway, if that had happened. But, you know, for Europe, it's a disaster in many ways, because, you know, the problem you have here is that Europe, as in current form, as current project, as the EU, isn't working. You have a two-tier economy in terms of North and South. You have a monetary policy that does not work for either of them. And you have enormous divisions across that society where unemployment is all over the place. Youth unemployment is shockingly high. You have enormous pools of people who feel the system has let them down. And in fact, it was interesting to go across Europe. The parties that are now coming into Europe are far, far more populist and in many ways much more extreme than the British. So, for example, if you go to Spain, you've got Podemos, which has done very well in the last election. In Italy, you've got the Five-Star Movement that has just won Rome and Turin, amongst others. Greece already has Syriza in power. Austria is about to rerun its presidential election as a far-right candidate as one of the two in the final runoff. So, you know, this is a continent that is actually falling apart the seams. And actually what Brexit does is it accelerates that for two reasons. One is that, firstly, Germany is even more isolated now, is the only one holding the checkbook. And bear in mind, if you think of all the, you know, huge kind of palpitations of a Greece leaving a few years ago, Greece represented 1.2% of the European economy. You've just had a country that represents 17% of the European economy leave. So the backing now for all these, you know, sovereign bonds in Italy and Spain, all the bank bailouts, etc., has just gotten that much weaker. Whether Britain officially took part or not, the balance sheet has become 17% weaker. So Germany now is in a much tougher position. And Germany, of course, has their own kind of, you know, far-right party emerging again called Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, which now has about 14% of the vote and likely will increase its vote share in the coming months as the ramifications of Brexit play out across Germany. Secondly, what's also happened is that across all of these countries, before where there was uncertainty about leaving, now you've actually created, for the first time, a decision which will now set in place a process and a blueprint. So now if you're the National Front in France, well, guess what, you're campaigning for Brexit. If you are now, you know, in the Netherlands, you will campaign for Nexit. If you are Spain, you will campaign for Spexit. I mean, now, unfortunately, the dominoes have a real danger of starting to fall. And the situation actually is very similar to the 1920s. Well, in the 1920s, when most of Europe owed huge amounts of money to the U.S. in terms of war debt, the British were the first ones to actually renegotiate their war debt. And they paid back the U.S. about 83 cents on the dollar. And immediately after that, over the next 7-8 years, the U.S. had 13 further renegotiations with different countries until finally the Italians were fascially late to the party and renegotiated their debt in 1931, I believe, paying back just 26 cents on the dollar. So, you know, the trend is well established.
So, I mean, so now we look at this. Now, I always thought the euro itself, I didn't think it was a great model to begin with. Now, you're more into that. You're there. You're an economist. Was it a great model in its design, or was it a flawed model to begin with?
Well, I think it was flawed in that they tried to aim for a currency union without having any political union. You know, I mean, what this reminds me of is that going back to U.S. history, if you go back to 1781 in the Articles of Confederation, back then they had a very similar situation in the U.S. where they'd managed to get all these states to kind of cohere together, but they didn't really have a federal government, didn't really have a lot of the apparatus in place, and so they found these things just didn't work. In the end, they tore it all up, and it went to the Declaration of Independence 2 years later in 1783. Europe has had the same problem. I mean, you know, the example I always use is that, you know, if you go to the States, by and large, most people in the States have a dual identity. You know, you're a New Yorker, you're a Texan, you're a Californian, but you're also an American. In Europe, unfortunately, if you ask somebody what they are, they're always going to be English or French or German or Dutch or whatever it may be. They will never think of themselves as being good Europeans. In fact, they need to be calling themselves good Europeans are probably the bureaucrats in Brussels. So that's the problem right there, which is if you don't have a population that buys into being part of a bigger whole, they'll never get along. Because the problem there becomes is that in the U.S., for example, or even in the U.K., you have money transfers taking place all the time between different states. I mean, for example, if you look at the U.K., Scotland, you know, has been very vociferous about wanting to leave in the aftermath of Brexit. But, you know, the U.K., by and large, actually subsidizes Scotland to the tune of about £4 billion a year. About the majority of jobs in Scotland are actually public sector jobs. So they have fewer private sector employees in Scotland than public sector. But by the way, no one in the U.K. complains about that because it's just seen as part of being one united country. Similarly, in the U.S., you've always had transfers between one state and the next when states need bailouts and stuff. Europe never had that. And so now, if you try and bail out the Greeks, everyone will grumble. If you blame out the Spanish, everyone will grumble. And there is no political unity. So how on earth can you then try and put in currency on top of it?
We'll answer that question when we come back from the break. This is Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, and the End of Brexit, and the End of the World. It's our guy, Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global. This is The Bubba Show. If you miss an episode, libertytalk.fm will get you the download. And as we've been saying, we just passed 225,000 downloads a month. We want to get to 300. I need your help. Make sure you go download it. The Bubba Show, Top Bob Moritz. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob after the break. The Bubba Show. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, author of Money Mania, panics, booms, and busts, and the end of Brexit. I'm just kidding. It's the booms, panics, and busts is correct. But anyways, so Dr. Bob, you were starting to lay it out for us and give us the educated version of what the hell's going on there.
Yeah. So going back to euro, the other problem with the euro is that it's basically become not dissimilar to the gold standard back in the 1920s, which is that you forced a bunch of countries that have very, very different economies and need different outcomes to tie themselves to one exchange rate, in this case, the euro. And that the problem is that the euro's monetary policy is always going to be set ultimately by Germany, because they're the dominant power. So if you look at what the euro is doing right now, it's being designed entirely to keep Germany's economy healthy. The monetary policy is one where the Germans, in effect, are suppressing interest rates, suppressing the exchange rate, with a view to boosting their own share of the global trade and the global economy. That is a disaster, by the way, for people like Spain, for Greece, for others. And they're suffering the consequences of that. I mean, they've had this forced impact for a long time with the Germans, where, in effect, you guys held the interest rates down way too low and allowed us to go buy all of your Mercedes and Porsches and things like that. Unfortunately, now the bills come around and you don't have it, so you go back to a guy who lent you all the money in the first place and says, I'm sorry, I can't give you any more. So you know, Europe has huge challenges internally, and it's very, very hard for me to see Europe in its current forms really surviving. I mean, the only possible silver lining to all of this is that the Europeans wake up, realize the internal tension, and actually look around at the political landscape, which reflects far more clearly the effect of these economic tensions that's playing out across the population. I mean, to give you an example, okay, I was in Switzerland a few weeks ago. Now, one of the main parties in Switzerland has put up all these wonderful posters. Let me describe one of them to you. It's a poster of a bunch of cartoon sheep. They're all white, but one black sheep. And somebody's pushing this black sheep over a line, and the slogan reads, kick the black sheep out. Now there's no way, by the way, you can describe that as being anything but racist. You know, I mean, it is utterly xenophobic in the most extreme sense. But by the way, guess what? Some of the mainstream parties doing it, and they don't have that same outrage there that you might have had in the US, the UK. So what it tells you is that, you know, as happens time and time again through human history, every time things get tough, people take it out on other people. They will never blame themselves. They will instead take it out on everybody else around them, because it's their fault that they're getting poorer. So Europe has some major issues to deal with. And it's fine, actually. The one irony of it is that Donald Trump must look across at the British political situation and think, wow, these guys become an even bigger laughing stock than I was. You know, because look at Britain right now. Britain has no government in power. It has no real government in waiting. It has no opposition. In fact, as far as I can tell, for the last week and a half, the entire country is being run out of Twitter and the 24-hour news cycle.
So now you have this. Now, in your opinion, this is a little bit off center, but Did the gambling, did the betting, you know, they made a big deal of that in the States, okay, about how the gambling was said that they were staying in for sure, okay? And, of course, did that have anything to do with the election, in your opinion? Did that mean anything to the overall thing, you know, where the gamblers were betting heavy that they were going to stay?
Well, I think people, I mean, this is a classic case of, you know, people look at the betting exchanges and read across from it into what's going to happen in the market, in the economy. I don't think that's strictly true for two reasons. One is, think about the people who actually use these betting exchanges. You know, they actually would have been, by the way, predominantly what one might have called the elite. In other words, well-educated people, probably working in financial markets or in professional jobs, who would have been ultimately putting money based on their reading of the economy, of what they were hearing from politicians and so on, and they're doing betting. The more ordinary person who has the angry vote, which, by the way, bear in mind, comes disproportionately in the UK from the working class, because especially in Northern England, that's what they suffered in the last few years. You know, they're not really necessarily going to be on these betting exchanges, but you've already got a bias there. The second thing is, you've got to think about how the probability is calculated. You know, if you and I go out there and we put down £5,000 each, that'll be £10,000 betting to remain, for the sake of argument. Against us, the kind of people who will be voting to leave normally put them much smaller bets because they are from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. So if you have 100 people against you putting down £10 bets, that's only £1,000. So it looks like the odds of leaving are much higher than the odds of, sorry, odds of remaining are much higher than the odds of leaving just because more money is being put. But if you break it down to actual numbers of people, two people in this scenario voted to remain and 100 voted to leave. So, you know, I think that's partly why the betting exchanges got it very wrong. The only other thing I'll say, actually, which probably shows my first point about who was using these exchanges, is that the betting exchanges were probably a very good way of trading sterling volatility against, say, the dollar, because you could see with the probability shifting that it was coming through the exchange rate as well, which probably tells you again that the people who were putting the bets in the betting exchanges came from the same backgrounds.
Have you been reading my blogs again? You know, I, you know what? This is a true story. Obviously, you're there and I'm here, but I wrote, first of all, the Thursday of the vote when they started, you know, the problem in the U.S. is, you know, or maybe there as well, but the press is too involved, and they make it seem like it's one way, right? So there is no other way. And I mean, they did that with Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton, where they, you know, they announced in the morning of the California election that Hillary was already the nominee, so nobody voted. Well, they kept pounding the fact that the bookmakers said that they're going to stay. The bookmakers, and I go, it doesn't matter what the bookmakers say. A, it's a parimutuel wagering, so it's a one against the other, number one. Number two, at the end of the day, a guy smart enough to manipulate the market makes a big enough bet on that exchange and gets you guys to cover it like you are, and then he goes into the market and he buys puts on the British pound, he buys puts on the exchange. He just arbitraged the entire market to a no loss position. He can only make $1 billion if he's correct, and you do what you did. And of course, that's exactly what happened, and that's how it all trade out. What do you think of that philosophy?
Hello.
You still there?
Yeah, sorry, you just said that for a second.
I said, what did you think of that philosophy as I went crazy?
Well, you know, look, you and I think very alike. I mean, it amazes me that, you know, the media in many ways has fallen hook, line, and sinker for a certain narrative. And I think one of the interesting things about Brexit, which it showed, was two things. One was how completely the media misread the mood of the public at large and were so out of touch with them. And secondly, what it also exposed, was perhaps how irrelevant economists were to the entire debate. Because, of course, prior to Brexit happening, the whole debate for a very, very long time on the Remain side was all about the economy. It was all about, you know, the hit to the economy if Britain left, the hit to trade, the uncertainty, and so on and so forth. And that actually made almost no difference to the result. You know, and I think it tells you that economists themselves have actually, unfortunately, in the last decade, really suffered as a profession. You know, they managed to call 2007-09 completely wrong. You know, what they unveiled thereafter in terms of QE and so on has only damaged the profession, I suspect, a lot more and made them feel a lot of touch. And that's not necessarily the whole economics profession. I mean, there are economists like myself and others, such as Keane, for example.
You're a realist. That's I gotta step in here because you're a realist, and most economists are not realists. They live in Fantasy Island, and it becomes a bigger problem when you're not willing to admit that there's a potential problem ahead of time and say, hey, this might be a problem. And you go, well, we can't decide until after it's over. I go, what do I need you? I don't need you to tell me when the problem is fixed. I need you to help warn me of the problem ahead of time. And other than guys like you, because you've always been straight up, Bob. We've done a lot of stuff together over the last few years, and you've always been right on top of it and really good about it. And you've never once failed, you know, from the what if I said it's a bubble and you agreed, you said yes, it's a bubble. And these guys have never, at least in my lifetime, now I'm 60, I've never heard them admit to the actual truth. We're with Dr. Bob Swarup. We're going to come back and discuss more of this economist thing because I'm sure he's got something to say, as he always does. And I want to talk about the election in Germany, about Merkel, what's going to happen there. We are with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as author of Money Mania, Booms, Busts, and Panics. is the guy. I tell you, he's a real life economist. He's a real built-in economist, and he'll give us his real opinion. This is the Bubba Show, Top Bubba Horowitz. If you miss an episode, go to libertytalk.fm, and you can download the Bubba Show every single day and get guys like Dr. Bob giving you the great information. We'll be back after the break. The Bubba Show, Top Bubba Horowitz. We will be right back.
Fly me to the moon.
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report.
Hear that whistle, it's 10 o'clock.
Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup. Camdor Global, Money Mania, Panic Spoons and Bust. Get it on Amazon, plus his other books. But, you know, make sure you check this guy out. He's the real deal. All right, so Dr. Bob, I was ripping economists. You are an economist. And I did exclude you because, again, you and I have talked many times. So tell my listeners why I'm right or why I'm wrong. I can take it if I'm wrong. But this is what I've noticed in my tenure and in my views here. So tell me if I'm right, if I'm wrong, and what should be done better.
Look, I think most economists, unfortunately, don't really bring real people into it. I mean, you know, there was a time, I think, many decades ago when people used to think about the population at large and bring in what we call today behavioral finance. Most economists, I guess, because the world's been such a benign place for the last 60, 70 years, kind of divorced politics and society entirely from economics, which is a pity. I think what it really means is that when most economists sit there making their toy models of how the world is and how it should be and how it should behave, they do it without any reference whatsoever to society and to politics, which is, to be frank, stupid, because you don't exist in a vacuum. You know, you live in a world where there are politicians and who react to the mood of the population around them, and you have people who will get angry and upset, and when enough of them do, they vote through change or they revolt. I mean, there's so many things that are happening right now which show this dynamic. You know, if you look at this huge wave of anger that is sweeping the U.S., Europe, even places like China, a lot of it comes right down to the fact that increasingly a big, big section of population feels as if they've not really had much of an economic miracle or, you know, renaissance for a long time. The U.S., for example, real wages haven't actually moved for 40 years. I mean, labor participation is dropping to a 40-year low. I mean, these are major issues which tell you that the economy, whatever it might be, isn't working for a lot of people. And that's not a, you know, left-wing, right-wing kind of thing. I mean, it's not really, it's independent of that. The reality is that capitalism's always had this amazing deal with democracy, which basically says that we'll work to create free markets and you'll make sure that there are lots and lots of people can participate in those free markets. Because, by the way, if the two of them happen, then the two of them survive. As long as you've got free markets, people see the benefits of growth and they feel a sharing in it. The more people that participate, the greater the profits are for the people who are providing capital. And therefore, the both benefit is a symbiosis. Unfortunately, what we've done in the last, I would say, two decades, really, especially in this century, has been really to stifle that exchange. And so what you now have is a rather bastardized form of capitalism which is really, you know, driven more by keeping whoever's there at the top at the top, rather than actually having that movement through society and through economy that you actually need to keep replenishing the flow.
I tell you, you better quit reading my blogs. I'm just kidding. I mean, but
we think the same, Doug. We think the same.
Obviously, you say it much more eloquently than I do, but you actually explained it. But so I've said this repeatedly. You know, I don't like the Federal Reserve. I was a fence hitter. Now I just don't like them. I think they're just, they just do a bad job. That, my opinion, this is not Dr. Bob's opinion. This is Bubba's opinion. They just do a crappy job. They have no idea where they're at, and they're lost. But all that being said, okay, so now they just put $4 trillion of inflow into the system over the last 7 years. And they, as you said, they didn't create anything, but they kept the rich, the poor entitled, and the middle class. They wiped them out and didn't make them any more money. So the average guy in the street, like me, is making less money than I was making before. There's no jobs available, and the jobs that they're creating that President Obama goes out and celebrates all the time are minimum wage jobs. So in my opinion, they've done a really crappy job at trying to do this. And I always said from the beginning, and I have video to prove this, that what they should have done, if they felt compelled to bail out the banks, which I'm not so sure if they should have just let them fail. That might have, and I probably would have let them fail, but you'll tell me that I was wrong, and I could very well be wrong on that point. However, if they would have created what we would call the war effect in the United States of America, we know what's happened after every war, markets and economies have boomed, and put all these middle-class workers to work rebuilding the United States of America for that $4 trillion they threw in a garbage can, we would be in a hell of a lot better shape today, because the middle class would be working, the middle class would be spending, the middle class would be thriving, and everybody would be happy, and so would the stock markets. What do you say?
Well, I think one of the mistakes they made was to really get so panicked that they felt they had to bail out everyone in the bank. You know, if you think about all the people who bought bonds, you know, and, you know, funded all these banks through all sorts of debt issuance and things like that. I mean, there's a reason why they call it credit risk. There's a reason why you get paid that coupon. It's because you take on the risk of default. So from that perspective, why they didn't burn the bondholders a bit more, I don't really understand, because in many ways they really felt they had to kind of bail out the bondholders as much as possible, and even to some extent rescue party equity holders. So that was a huge mistake. I think one of the challenges, and unfortunately, is that I suspect, by the way, if they had chosen to use that money elsewhere, I'm not sure it would have been in a happier place right now anyway. Because part of the problem you have here is that there is a certain mode of thinking that policymakers have fallen into. There is a certain mode of GDP growth that they've fallen into. And if you think about it, one of the fundamental debates we should have is what is actually GDP for us? You know, what does it mean? What kind of model of growth do we want? I mean, GDP is nothing more than, you know, a mechanism of measuring growth that a bureaucrat dreamt of nearly 100 years ago. And stayed with us ever since. And no one actually questions what they're saying. You know, Todd, if you and I, by the way, went out right now after the show and had a few dozen bottles of Cristal champagne and blew, you know, $10,000, $20,000, or if we took that same amount of money and put it into a factory and invested it, you know and I know exactly what the outcome of both those is. The first one is a great night out with a bad hangover. The second one has something that has the potential of returning far more money in the future. However, as far as GDP is concerned, both have the exact same impact on GDP. And so if you think about that for a second, what it drives you as a policymaker, without you even realizing this is perhaps the unconscious cognitive bias of a policymaker, it drives you towards concluding that consumption is the best form of growth. And so what you do is you create an economy where actually we're always being asked to consume all the time. In fact, savings has a very negative connotation amongst policymakers. Savings are bad. They're seen as being bad. The problem, however, is if people consume more than they earn, well, that becomes debt. And while a bit of debt in the economy is good for spurring growth, too much debt eventually begins to strangle growth as well. And that's where we ended up. We've ended up in a world where debt, to give you an example of how bad debt has become, in 1990, according to the Bank of International Settlements, global debt markets were approximately $10 trillion in size. 25 years later, in 2015, there were $100 trillion in size. So they had gone up in 25 years by 10 times. And by the way, GDP globally in those 25 years did not go up by 10 times. So you immediately have a system that has more and more debt and has become more and more leveraged. And, well, we know how leverage works. The reality is you take on some leverage, it's great for returns. You take on too much leverage, you will fall over. And that's the problem. The credit system is so fragile that, for example, if 2007 hadn't pushed it over the edge, something else would have. And the bit that actually scares me is that the global debt since 2008 is 60% higher today.
Yes.
So we haven't learned the lesson. We've just been adding on more and more debt. And if you look at, by the way, the reaction to Brexit, it's actually been to reemphasize the need for more central bank accommodativeness. You know, every bank out there suddenly decided they need to do more. They need to, you know, pump in more money.
And isn't that stupid? Serious. I know it might be bright words, but I'm going to say it the way I feel it. Isn't that stupid?
Yeah. Well, I think it's completely missing the wood for the trees. I mean, you're so busy fighting the battle day in, day out, that you're completely failing to see the bigger term impact. Instead, I suspect actually most policymakers are terrified right now because they're kind of waking up to the fact that many of them are in the same straitjacket as most economies are, that they're kind of in this mode of behavior where they're doing the same thing again and again. And I mean, remember Einstein's definition of insanity is to do the same thing again and again, expect a different outcome.
And they never get a different outcome because they do this ridiculous, you know, that is, it's funny because today auto debt in the United States is bigger than the housing bubble debt. Okay. So, but they continue to want to build debt. And then, of course, the way that they try to resolve the debt is they try to, what I say, borrow their way out of debt. But they also, every time they hit the printing press, what are they really doing? They're really taking away money from me and my other Americans because they're devaluing my currency and creating the sense of inflation, which is really just another tax for me because they're actually devaluing what I own. So I have a real big problem with all of that, and we're going to get the answers because Dr. Bob is kicking ass today. He's taking names and he's letting us know exactly. Now I want to know how many economists you've ever heard come out and tell you exactly what he's thinking, but this is Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as the author of a number of books, but the Money Booms, Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. You guys got to get that from Amazon because you got to see what this guy's having to say. I'm telling you, you don't get it any straight shooter than you get from Dr. Bob. This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. If you miss an episode, go to libertytalk.fm and you can download the Bubba Show every day, as well as the Sporting Edge. And while you're doing that, check out BubbaTrading.com. As we get into these war wild times, you know, we have the hedging model. The hedging software is now out. The only caveat that you have to go on through the hedging class and you can get the automated software. But check out BubbaTrading.com to find out. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bob Horowitz here with Dr. Bob Swarup. We'll be back right after the break. The Bubba Show. Todd Bob Horowitz. Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, and there's more to that title, but check it out on Amazon. You can't miss him. He's all over Google. He is the guy, and he is my man, and I appreciate what he tells me. Okay, so now you've got this whole debt structure, which is brutal, and as I said before we're going to break, they're really just taking money out of my pocket when they print it, because all they're doing is distributing more. It's like doing a secondary issuing in stock. They're taking away what my ownership is and diluting it. What do you say?
Well, I mean, this is why you got so much anger, right? Because the thing is, what you're feeling, kinds of other people are, they just can't articulate it, and so they get angry at the system. If you think about debt, the problem with too much debt is it also enhances inequality even more, because the people who buy the debt are always going to be much fewer in number than the ones who take advantage of it. So, you know, longer term, you will always end up forcing people further and further apart, creating divisions. You know, it's interesting if you go back in history, the first ever laws that came up were all to do with debt management, nothing else, because they quickly realized that if you don't handle debt properly, you really can tear society apart. And we're seeing that because we've kind of forgotten the bad side of debt. And what really amazes me is that these days, you know, debt restructuring is a really nasty word. I mean, nobody talks about it. You know, and the bizarre thing is, look, We accept personal bankruptcies. We accept corporate restructurings. And these are all seen as very necessary parts of capitalism to ensure that people can put the bad stuff away, creditors take what they can, and then you move on. And yet we don't actually apply that at a societal level or at a sovereign level. Somehow, if you're a sovereign or if you're a society at large, this notion of restructuring debt, whether it's auto loans or sovereign debt or whatever, is something that's just not on the table. And if you talk about it, you talk about it always in these very socialist terms like debt forgiveness, which is bizarre because actually all it is the most simple basic free markets thing of if the debt is bad, you take what you can, the rest you write off. That is what we have done, by the way, throughout history. So why on earth we can't do that today beggars belief. I mean, I suggested in a paper 3 years ago that the way to deal with the European debt crisis when you had Spain, Italy, all these guys being basket cases was to do a modern version of Brady bonds, where you basically looked at it all and you said, what is actually repayable? And let's write the rest off, restructure it, extend the term, and, you know, do it that way. Because then what you do is, firstly, you get rid of the stuff that's holding you back. You actually get these guys to be growing again, and you hopefully can then benefit from that. And you start afresh, so the system actually has capacity now to grow.
Isn't that amazing? See, now, why is it? Now, see, here's the difference. And this is my opinion, and you can rebut, agree, or tell me I'm nuts. But it seems to me that the Fed, for sure, and other central banks, they have an ulterior agenda, okay, because the solutions are so simple that a fifth grader can figure them out on how to take care of these, but yet they continue to fall into the same trap. So are they really falling into the same trap? Or are they really doing this intentionally to create exactly the mess that they're creating, giving them actually more power over the system and making them more needed when in your imagination?
You know, I'm not sure I'd want the kind of power they have over the system right now, because the way it's going is right now going through a wonderful bonfire of vanity at the rate they're going. So my honest belief is that it's a combination of two things. One is that in their little intellectual castle, they've never considered a lot of these real-life issues. I mean, you know, a lot of economists even now don't fully appreciate what debt actually is and how it works. And the financial markets are a very different beast to them than, say, a conceptual economy. The second problem is that if you think about who they're talking to and they're trying to get their opinions, who they're speaking with, these are all people who will have their own agendas. They're all people who will be looking for, you know, their own particular agenda. So, you know, if you're sitting there talking to a bunch of banks, for example, as a Fed, saying, you know, what should we do? Well, do you think a bank's really going to turn around and say, you guys should restructure us and burn the bondholders? I kind of doubt it, right? It's like turkeys voting for Christmas.
Well,
they just do it.
I mean, I would think, you know, that if you're a conspiracy theorist, you know, I would think that, you know, obviously J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs own part of the Federal Reserve, right? It's a private corporation owned by the banks. And I mean, I wouldn't be, the conspiracy theory is that when Lehman and Bear Stearns went under, Jamie Dimon wanted Bear Stearns and he wanted Lehman out. So that's how that somehow magically that worked out. So if you're a conspiracy guy, you could believe that was actually the issue. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a little bit of funny business going on there, in my own opinion. What do you think?
Well, look, I think everyone will always have their own agenda. I don't necessarily subscribe to that conspiracy theory.
That's okay.
But, you know, but I would certainly believe, by the way, that, you know, in 2007, 2008, and so on, all the banks were at the Fed telling them exactly how terrible it was going to be if they went under and how they had to be bailed out. Otherwise, the world was going to die. And, I mean, you know, I think the problem is the Fed, in that environment, particularly with all the political pressure on them, because no politician wants anything going wrong on their watch, they would have turned around and they would have immediately done what they could to bail people out. In fact, I mean, you know, I'll give you an example is I had a dinner with a central banker about quite a few years ago, in fact. This was shortly after the financial crisis, about 2 or 3 years later. And he basically, you know, was telling me about how they'd come up with their, you know, special resolution mechanisms so that the next time J.P. Morgan or anybody else got into trouble, they'd be able to actually shut down parts of the bank and mitigate a Lehman-type scenario. And, you know, I thought, well, fantastic, but I don't really believe that. And I asked him, are you sure it works? And he was convinced that it worked. He felt they'd done their job, they'd really looked at this, they'd really understood how a bank could be shut down. But then he got paused for a second. He said, but he goes, the only problem, he said, is that if I took that to a politician, he probably would say to me, not on my watch, just bail them out.
You're right. So, I'm sorry.
That's the thing, right? It's the behavioral thing again, right? You can't walk away from the person, and the politician is still a person.
It's the Pavlov dog theory. So now let me ask you a question. I don't think I've ever asked this before. If you were in charge of the Fed in 2008, what would you have done?
Well, you know, I think hindsight's a beautiful thing. Let me put it this way. Let's pretend I'm in the Fed now and we're going forward.
Okay.
Because guess what? The next crisis is a lot worse, and we know that. Debt is bigger. You've got too big to fail. What do you do now? Well, I'll tell you one thing that I think the Fed actually is doing that is quite good. Amazing words, but it's true. Which is that if you look at what they've done in the last year or so, is they've slowly been increasing their capital ratios for banks. Not nearly enough, but they've been doing that. And I think that's good, because what that is doing is it's slightly reducing the leverage in the system, forcing them to deleverage a bit, but also it's making it disadvantageous for the really big banks to remain as big banks. At some point, shareholders will start to demand higher returns on equity, and that will force them to break themselves up. So I think that's a good start. I think what I'd probably also do is actually start to map out some kind of path back to normalization. If you don't get back to normalization, you really have a problem here. I mean, at the moment, if you look at what's going to happen with interest rates, if you're in a pension fund or an insurance company, this low interest rate environment, which keeps creeping lower and lower every year, by the way, is killing you. Your liabilities are much longer duration than your assets. So every time the yield curve goes down, no matter how much it bumps out equity prices or bond prices, it hits your liabilities much harder and your funding position worsens that much more. To give you an example, after Brexit, when the yield curve in the UK gapped down by basically 0.5% because they expected 2 rate cuts to follow, at that point, most insurance companies in the UK lost about 20% of their solvency. So, you know, it gives you an idea. I mean, the entire pensions industry in the UK lost £80 billion overnight.
The pension system around the world is in big, big trouble, but that'll be our next conversation. Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, author of Money Mania, Panic, Booms, and Busts. I love having you on, and I really love your honesty and candor. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
This is Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global. Wrote the book. Check him out on Amazon. Get that book in your hands. We need some royalties because of Brexit. So you got to make sure we get taken care of. Dr. Bob, he's always tells like it is, but I think you really appreciate how he just sits there and spells it out. This has been The Bubba Show. If you missed an episode, libertytalk.fm. Get you the download. Other than that, Dr. Bob was awesome. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same station. This is The Bubba Show, Top Bubba Horts. Everybody have a great day. We appreciate you. We'll see you back here tomorrow. The Bubba Show, Top Bubba Horts. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.